Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge, and we're glad to have you listening. In this first hour of the program, we'll be looking at what is a very old kind of ideological struggle between science on the one hand and religious faith on the other. And the question that we'll be looking at this morning is this: is it possible to be both a scientist and a person of faith? And I'm sure that there are a lot of people who would say no, that's just not possible. However, our guest this morning, geneticist Francis Collins, says speaking for himself, he sees no conflict between being a rigorous scientist and believing in God. And in fact, he argues that these two perspectives can indeed coexist within one person and do so in a way that enriches the human experience. This morning, in this hour of the show, we'll be talking with Dr. Collins about how the discoveries in biology that he helped to oversee indeed enhanced his religious faith. He lays out some of these ideas in a book that was just published this past summer, a book that has gotten quite a bit of attention. The title is The Language of God, A Scientist Presents Evidence for Belief. It's published by Free Press. Dr. Francis Collins is a physician and geneticist. He led the International Human Genome Sequencing Consortium and its effort to sequence the entire human DNA code, the Human Genome Project. He has an undergraduate degree in chemistry from University of Virginia. He went on to obtain a PhD in physical chemistry at Yale, and then recognizing that something very important was going on in molecular biology and genetics, he changed fields and he enrolled in medical school at the University of North Carolina and continued in Chapel Hill for his residency and chief residency in internal medicine. He's joining us this morning by telephone. And as we talk, questions are certainly welcome. The only thing that we ask of people who are calling is that callers are brief, and we ask that so that we can get in as many different people as possible as would like to join us and keep the program moving along. Here in Champaign-Urbana, the number to call, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, and that means if it would be a long-distance call, if you're listening around Illinois and Indiana, in fact, if you're listening any place in the United States, if you're listening on the Internet, you may also use that toll-free line, and that is 800-222-9455. Again, 333-9455 if you are here in Champaign-Urbana, where we are, and any place else, 800-222-9455. Dr. Collins, hello.
Well, good morning.
Well, thank you very much for talking with us today.
It's a pleasure to be on your program, David.
I hope at this point you have not tired of this subject yet.
Oh, no, not at all. I never tire of this one. This is like the big question.
Well, it's interesting, somebody like you to take such a strong sort of stand in this, what is, I'm sure, a difficult position, saying, yes, it is possible to believe and also to be a scientist. So I think that, among other things, it puts you in a kind of out there by yourself, because you have been criticized both by scientists for bringing God into the matter of creation and also by many believers who don't accept the idea of evolution. And you make the argument that you think that there was a creator, but that evolution was the mechanism. And you dispute the kind of view of the scripture that says, well, this is a work of journalism and not a work of poetry. So it sort of puts you out almost in a territory all by yourself, or at least in a small group of people.
Well, it might seem that way, and I think that's in part because scientists have generally not felt comfortable weighing in on this kind of a subject. But actually, if you look at the surveys that have been done of working scientists, some 40% of us are people who both believe that science is the way to uncover how the natural world works and also believe in a God who answers prayer. And that surprises people, because the noise that you hear primarily coming from the scientific community when the subject of faith comes up is of a more negative sort.
Well, I think also that might be among those people who would take that position that says, yes, you can be a scientist and be a person of faith, might also feel that it would be more prudent for them to be a little bit more quiet about their beliefs and not be quite so public about them as you have.
I think that's true. There's a taboo in the scientific community about discussing these matters, and you can sort of see the eyebrows go up when that taboo is broken, and certainly younger scientists, I think, feel quite vulnerable if they get into this territory, that people will begin to ask, are they really as rigorous as they should be, or is this somebody who's gone a little soft, and gee, should that guy really get tenure? So there is clearly a strong message that's being distributed, not explicitly, but implicitly in the scientific community, that this is not a topic for discussion in the seminar room.
Religion did not, as I understand it, play a particularly strong role in your upbringing, at least not when you were younger.
Not at all. I was raised in a family which had many wonderful opportunities of exposure to theater and literature and the arts and music, but virtually none to the principal tenets of faith. My parents were free thinkers for whom faith was not something to discount, but certainly not something to pay much attention to. So as I got older, went to college, encountered people who were asking questions about what various people believed, I realized I didn't believe any of the things that some of my friends were talking about, and I became first an agnostic, and then ultimately in graduate school in chemical physics, I became an atheist who really felt that the only things that could matter in the universe were mathematics, physics, and chemistry.
And I guess, again, as you explained, that the point when you really started to think differently came when you were in your medical training, and that in the course of that training, you were spending time with people, working with people who were dying, and were confronting some of these large questions, and that perhaps forced you to also confront some of them.
Well, there's nothing like being faced with almost certain death to change people's view from the abstract considerations to something much more explicit about, is there a God, does he care about me, and what happens after you die? And my considerations of faith had been purely abstract until that experience of being a medical student sitting at the bedside of people who were facing terrible futures. And to see so many of them leaning so heavily on their faith and not, in fact, running away from faith when it seemed as if something terrible was happening to them, oftentimes not of their own doing, that was puzzling, and it got my attention. And one of my patients one afternoon, after telling me about her faith, turned to me and said, "Well, what do you believe, doctor?" And I realized I didn't have a good answer, and I suddenly felt that my own atheist position had been very thinly defended and very thinly arrived at, and I'd better run out there quickly and come up with a better defense of my position and not be in that awkward kind of position.
I think the purpose of the book, in a sense, is to talk about how it is possible to engage the issue of faith and of God in a rational way, and I think that some people would say that's really the difficulty, in fact, that might be the impossibility. They would say that faith is exactly what it says. It's faith, and that it's not, one cannot either prove or disprove the existence of God. Either you're going to believe or not, and that's where the leap of faith comes in. And the idea of trying to, in a kind of a, apply a sort of a rational kind of mindset to the question of God, existence or not, it's, you just can't do it.
Well, I think faith has been given short shrift in that kind of depiction. From my own perspective, having then approached this question of whether God is a plausible entity or whether all of the rational arguments lead you in the other direction, I found, after considering the evidence from many different aspects of the universe as well as who we are as people, that I reached the conclusion that it was much more plausible to believe in a God than it was to discount his existence. And that was a surprise to me, and I think it's probably a surprise to many people. There is this rumor out there that, you know, faith is the opposite of reason. I don't think that's true at all. I think faith is reason plus revelation. Science is probably reason alone. But these are not sort of completely competing, conflicting ways of finding truth. They are ways of finding different kinds of truth. They're different kinds of knowing. But faith, I think, can be approached from a purely rational perspective. What you can't do is to get ultimate proof, and I don't think you ever will, but you can certainly arrive at the conclusion, as I did at age 27, that belief in God was more plausible than being an atheist.
So if I understand right, what you're saying is that you believe that there was an initial cause of everything, that there was a creator, but that the kind of mechanisms that we've come to understand, evolution, natural selection, and so forth, was the mechanism. Do you, and so in a sense that you would say that the creator touched off the spark and then things went from there, do you believe that God is involved in a direct way with human beings and with the world on a daily basis?
I do, and there's a lot of sort of very important issues tied into the question you just asked, so let me step back a minute and sort of make first the argument about the need to postulate the existence of God to have the universe exist in the first place. we now know the universe had a beginning, the Big Bang, some 13 or 14 billion years ago, in an incredible flash, a singularity of energy and matter. And if nature cannot create itself, and it's very hard for me to see how that could be, then you have to postulate that some creator was responsible for that, and the creator would have to be outside of nature, and that sounds like God. And I think even those who are not inclined to believe in a personal God have to look at that particular argument and say it is quite plausible to say there is something outside of nature that's responsible for our being here at all. Then you can look at the fine-tuning of the universe in a remarkable series of observations, many of them really only noticed in the last 20 or 30 years, to say that all of the physical constants that basically determine the qualities of matter and energy that we see now having been set at a particular point had to be set in a very precise way for matter to coalesce, for stars, planets, and galaxies to occur. And that seems impossible to explain on the basis of pure coincidence, and certainly suggests that there was an intention in setting those parameters in a certain way. If gravity, for instance, had been off by just one part in 100 million million, there would have been no coalescence of planets and no possibility of life. The Big Bang would have gone on exploding forever, or would have come back together in a big crunch. And that's fascinating to consider. Then you have to get to the question of, okay, maybe that is an argument for a deist kind of God that cared about having a universe, but where's the argument that God would care about humans and everyday affairs, which was where your question was going? Mm-hmm. And there, I think, the arguments that I find most compelling are those that indicate what's special about humans, and what is particularly special about us, when you think about it, is this knowledge that we all have ingrained within us of right and wrong, the so-called moral law. It's not a law that we always listen to, and in some instances, humans are capable of doing horrible things that are totally against the law. But nobody argues about the fact that there is such a thing as right and wrong. They simply defend what they've done as having been right. And that's curious. And despite the efforts of evolutionary biologists and sociobiologists to explain this as an evolutionary consequence, I don't find those completely account for the most amazing things that people sometimes do in a sacrificial way to help each other.
Well, I think that's a fascinating point, and that is one that you and others have used to try to demonstrate, or is as a way to build this argument that there is a God and he designed people with certain kinds of features. I'm sure, though, at the same time, for example, if you look at just that very issue of altruism, that there are some people who would make the argument that maybe indeed there is a gene for altruism. We think that there are genes for a lot of other things, and that you could easily make an argument that says that would contribute to the survival of some over some others. That if in a moral sense, if altruism, if an urge to try to preserve and work for the well-being of our fellow members of our species, if that has an adaptive value, then that's going to end up helping those people. That will be passed on. And it's not impossible to make that kind of argument for those sorts of things.
And those arguments have been made, and they're interesting to consider. And there may be some component of evolutionary selection for this kind of behavior when it comes to assisting your own kin, because they share your DNA. Remember, though, evolution operates on the individual, not on the group. And when you look at the examples that we today perhaps admire most, the examples of someone like Mother Teresa or Oscar Schindler, who risked his life saving all of these people from the Holocaust, they were not helping their kin. They were helping people from another tribe, if you will, and yet we admire that. And evolution finds that scandalous, that you basically would put your DNA at risk to help somebody from a competing group. I think that's intriguing. And the other aspect of this one has to come to grips with, if you want to explain altruism on purely evolutionary basis, the conclusion of that you cannot escape from, is that there really is no such thing as right and wrong, that it's purely a sort of an artifact of evolutionary selection, and it has no absolute meaning. And I think most of us faced up with that kind of conclusion recoil a bit from it and think, now, wait a minute, is that really consistent with what we know as human beings?
Our guest in this part of Focus 580 is Dr. Francis Collins. He's one of the country's leading geneticists and longtime head of the Human Genome Project. He is the author of a book that's titled The Language of God, A Scientist Presents Evidence for Belief. It's published by the Free Press, in which he lays out some of his ideas, his beliefs, and makes the very basic argument that we have been making here, that it is not impossible for someone to be both a scientist and a person of religious faith. Questions, comments are certainly welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. We do have a couple of callers here, one who has been waiting patiently since the beginning, so we'll get right there, and that's Champagne and line one. Hello.
Yeah, hi, good morning. Mm-hmm. Dr. Collins, I'd like to find out a little bit more about your beliefs about God. You are a Christian?
Yes.
And you believe that Jesus is the Son of God?
I do.
And that Jesus was human, but he had no biological father?
I do.
And he died and was resurrected?
I do.
And the Bible is the Word of God?
Let's be careful about that. I think the Bible has many different components. I don't think that Genesis 1, for instance, is intended to teach us about science or to be taken literally as a 6 days of creation description by people who were there as eyewitnesses, because clearly it was not written from that perspective. But I think some other parts of the Bible are written very much as the record of history by eyewitnesses and ought to be interpreted as such unless there's evidence to the contrary.
But the Bible is inspired by God.
I believe the people who wrote it were inspired by God. I'm not sort of one of those who completely subscribes to the idea that therefore every word came out of God's mouth.
Okay, but it has a special status that the Quran doesn't have.
Let's be careful about that as well. I'm not an exclusivist. I think there are many ways that one can find truth about God's character, and I think Christianity for me has become the way where I found that most compellingly, but I would be very hesitant to say that that is, in fact, in some way a superior method to others who have found the truth in other fashions. Everyone has their own opportunity and responsibility to see what they can find as far as the truth of God's existence.
So you don't believe that people who believe in other religions are going to go to hell if they're not Christian?
That does not seem consistent with what I know about God's love on many other bases.
Okay. Well, that's sort of like maybe 4 out of 5. And I'm just curious, the reasoning that you use in terms of a scientist for these miracles about Christianity, is this the same type of, a rational thinking that you use for the existence of God in itself? Because it's hard for me to see how a scientist would specifically get that specific about Christianity and the truth of virgin births and resurrection and these types of things. What is the evidence for that particular brand of belief in God as a scientist?
Yeah, again, I think when you ask about evidence for things in the spiritual realm, you have to be cautious about what tools you're going to use to find that evidence. Arthur Eddington tells a wonderful parable about the fellow who decided he was going to characterize all of the creatures in the deepest, darkest parts of the ocean, and so he set about with a set of nets that had a mesh size of 3 inches to see what he could catch, and after several years, he wrote a paper describing all of this, and the last paragraph of his paper said, and the most amazing thing that he discovered was there were no creatures at that depth of the ocean that were smaller than 3 inches. In a certain way, when we apply the tools of science to try to determine aspects of things that are not entirely in the natural world, but also have a component of the supernatural, of the spiritual, then we have to recognize those limitations. I think the question of miracles really devolves rather quickly in terms of whether you believe in them or not, to whether you believe in a God, and whether you believe in a God who is at least in part outside of nature. If you do, and most of us do, then there's no reason why that God could not occasionally invade the natural, and that would appear to us as a miracle, where the natural laws that God had designed in the first place were suspended. So I have no trouble with the notion that miracles could exist. I've never personally seen one, but when it comes to something as significant for me in my Christian faith as the existence of Jesus and his death and resurrection, I don't find those to be intellectually difficult to accept once I've accepted the idea of a creator God who cares about human beings and who is outside of nature.
But if God is outside of nature creating miracles, we should be able to see evidence for those miracles in nature. So what is the evidence for any miracle within nature that people would look at and say, yeah, there must be a God? For example, if you went back 6,000 years in the fossil record and you saw everything appeared then and there was no life before, that would be pretty spectacular evidence of a miracle, but we don't find that.
We certainly don't.
And so what is there physically in terms of scientific evidence for any miracle ever having been occurred ever?
Again, I think if you're using the tools of science to investigate the miraculous, you're already on potentially thin ice. And I also think that God doesn't allow miracles to just happen at random for us to be able to see his power. If you read John Polkinghorne, the wonderful Anglican priest who went from being a physicist, a very well-recognized one, to being a very thoughtful theologian, he argues that if you look at the instances of the miraculous that are recorded in theological traditions, they come at great ganglions of history where there is some significant event that really reveals something significant about God's character, and they don't just happen willy-nilly as the act of a cosmic magician.
Mm-hmm. I see. Okay, well, I guess you're sort of suggesting that you need sort of faith and revelation to believe in miracles. And
I think that's exactly right. I think if you don't believe in God, you probably aren't going to believe in miracles. And to get the faith in God, you can reason yourself right to the edge of that chasm, and then you have to decide to leap. That was a scary thing for me 27 years ago, but I'm glad I took the leap.
Yeah, okay. Well, some of us are not going to do that. Okay, thank you very much.
Well, thanks for the call. Well, just real quick here, I guess I would could imagine that one of the things that perhaps some scientists would argue in arguing against the belief in God is they would say something like, well, as a scientist, I have to believe that while there are many unanswered questions, that it is possible by applying the scientific method and thinking very hard and over time, as our knowledge grows, to get to answers to those unanswered questions. And as a scientist, I would have to say, I don't really believe that there are any questions that science cannot answer, except maybe when it comes to the existence of God. I think that'd be one I would say, well, I don't think that, again, it would be something that, well, we can't prove that there is God, we can't prove that there isn't. And that's where I think I would think maybe your scientific faith starts to bump up against the scientific, your religious faith bumps up against the scientific method, because it says that, you know, there are things, that questions that cannot be answered by science. And somehow, as a scientist, that rankles.
It rankles, and I think that may be why many scientists are uncomfortable discussing this topic, because in a certain way it's a bit of a threat to what we spend our life doing, which is trying to understand things about the natural world using the tools of science. But I think, David, you said it very well. There are questions that are incredibly important, maybe the most important questions of human existence, that science is simply powerless to address. And one of them is there a God? And another is, why am I here anyway? And another is, why is there anything instead of nothing? And another is, what happens after you die? Down through the centuries, have those not been the questions that have most occupied the most thoughtful people? And yet, they are scientifically not addressable. And what troubles me is that our scientific culture and our increasingly technological culture, at least in the West, seems to have lost some focus in terms of trying to address those questions, or has just become uneasy with them and put them off the table as being basically not something that's worth spending time on because you can never find answers. Well, I think faith is the way to find one's answers. It is based upon a different kind of knowing, a different kind of adventure in yourself, but it is intensely rewarding if you're willing to take the chance on it.
Let's talk with some other people who are listening. We have somebody on a cell phone. This is line number 3. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Mike Dobra here.
Yes, go ahead.
Hi. Wonderful conversation, wonderful topic. My question was, the thing that I try to reason with myself is, the initial spark of life, millions and millions of years ago. I don't have an issue with evolution, but that initial spark of life, it seems so improbable to me that that would just be an accidental occurrence. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Well, it's a great question, and it's a very open question right now. No one really has a good explanation for how that first self-replicating organism came to pass. We know that 4 billion years ago, the Earth was inhospitable to any living form that we could recognize, and yet 3.85 billion years ago, it was teeming with single-celled organisms, and that's a pretty short period of time. to have all of that develop when you consider the necessity of these macromolecules that would carry information and allow replication to come to pass. And all of the experiments that people have done going back to the 1950s with the famous Miller-Urey experiment have fallen vastly short of anything that approaches reasonable probability of the kind of life that we now recognize having spontaneously arisen in such a short period of time. So one is forced to the conclusion that there's some pathway towards that that we haven't yet learned about, and some people are arguing that it wasn't DNA, it was RNA that was the first self-replicating molecule, and there's some evidence for that, but even there we're way short of having an explanation that's even vaguely statistically probable. No less a notable molecular biologist and Nobel Prize winner and also a prominent atheist than Francis Crick, faced with this, said, you know, it must have come from outer space. Well, that doesn't seem very satisfying because it would still have to start somewhere. So I think we have an unsolved problem. It is tempting as a believer to say, oh, well, God did it because we don't have an answer. But I would really warn against that, since that's a kind of God of the gaps approach that hasn't fared so well in the past. And ultimately, we may come up with a plausible mechanism to explain how life arose. And you wouldn't want, therefore, to have your faith all shaken up by having placed it unnecessarily on that kind of an argument. And I think from my perspective, where I see God as the creator that started the universe at the moment of the Big Bang and had the plan from that very first moment of how life would arise and how evolution would be the mechanism that ultimately gave rise to you and me, it really doesn't matter whether God had to take an initial extra step there to get life going or whether that was already pre-programmed. It was still his work.
Fascinating. Thank you very much.
Thank you. I realize we, in a sense, I'm going over the same ground again, but I suppose the thing that I'm having a difficult time with is the idea that says if science cannot explain, if we could, maybe we could do everything, we could run the clock back, so to speak, to the moment of the Big Bang. If we can explain all that, how that had worked, we still have this problem. What came before that?
Yeah.
And if what you do, though, is you resort to the idea of a creator providing the spark and setting the process that we have come to understand in motion, even if we say the process as we understand it worked as we understand it, but we've got to come up with a first cause. I guess I'm still having trouble with the notion that says that if science can't explain this, then we're having to resort to, in a sense, a mystical explanation, which is completely unscientific. And I guess I'm still having a hard time with how it is you can accept the Big Bang and evolution and the scientific story of the universe back to the point of this question of how did it start, and then accept this sort of non-rational, take this non-rational mystical explanation. I don't understand how you can still have both those things.
No, it's a very appropriate question. I think basically what I'm saying is that science, trying to look back through time beyond that singularity that represents the origin of the universe, it gets you outside of the realm where scientific tools can give you an answer, and you're then really much more in that other realm we were talking about a minute ago, about questions like, is there a God? To ask the question, what came before? It is not a question that science has the tools or the abilities to address. And in that regard, I think this is not a gap in our understanding of the natural world where we should be careful not to place God if science is going to be able to answer the question. This is a different sort of question. And in that regard, it does seem an appropriate question, therefore, to pick other tools. And some of those tools are just simple logic. If the universe began, if matter now exists, and it had a beginning at a particular point in time, unless you're going to say the universe created itself, and we've not observed that as something that could happen, then you have to postulate a creator, and you have to say the creator is outside of space and time. Otherwise, you get into what's called an infinite regress about who created the creator or who moved the prime mover, which is a very unsatisfying place to be. And then that forces you to say the creator must not themselves be natural, but supernatural. And on the basis of just that kind of argument, you find yourself in a metaphysical realm. But so be it. Those are the intellectual arguments we have at our disposal, and I don't think we should be afraid of the answer.
You think, just very quickly, and I have some other questions here. You talked earlier about the fact that obviously throughout human existence, some of the big questions that people have wrestled with are questions like, well, why are we here? How did we get here? What is there some sort of purpose to the world and to human life? Do you think that it is not possible for science to answer a question like that? Is there no possible scientific explanation or answer to a question like, does human life serve some sort of a purpose?
I'm afraid that science really doesn't help you with that. And the more prominent atheists amongst my colleagues, like Richard Dawkins, for instance, would say that that is a question that you're not going to like the answer to, which is that there is no point to human life, that the universe is exactly what you'd expect if there was no creator, no purpose, no meaning, nothing but blind, pitiless indifference to the existence of all of us. So if one rules out the possibility of anything other than the natural world, other than materialism, and you adopt that as your faith, and that also requires faith, I should say, because it requires you to say you know this to be true without having a proof, then the consequence is basically to rule out of order any of those questions that you've just verbalized, especially the one about why am I here?
I suppose that gets it to what is, I suppose some people would argue that the problem with being an atheist, or maybe the reason that more people aren't, is that it's just too frightening. Because essentially what it says is that really there is no, it answers that question, what is there meaning? The question is, answer to the question is no,
right.
There's
right.
not. And that I'm sure some people would argue that would make it very difficult to live. And so for that reason, we've come up with some kind of explanation, some sort of answers to that question, because having no answer is pretty unsettling.
Yeah, and it is a reasonably depressing kind of conclusion one has to come to. On the other hand, the atheist will say, well, that's too bad. You know, buck up, grow up. This is the reality. Get used to it. I would retort that, in fact, it's not just the fact that atheism leaves you with a rather bleak view. It also is an irrational position to take. Imagine, if you will, that you were asked to draw a circle that contains all the knowledge that exists or will ever exist, sort of imagine what that circle would look like. And then ask, what would the circle look like that contains what you know right now at this moment in time? And even the most confident person will draw a rather small, tiny circle relative to the big one. Suppose the knowledge of the existence of God happens to be outside your circle. That seems plausible, given the relative scales. Then how can it be a rational position for anybody to say with absolute certainty there is no God? That is the least rational of all options. It is the one that seems the most far away from approaching this from a purely intellectual perspective. And it seems, therefore, surprising that some adopt that view who claim to be doing so on the basis of pure rationality.
We have a number of other calls. We'll try to get in as many as we can. We have about 20 minutes left in this part of Focus. Let me introduce again our guest, Dr. Francis Collins. He's one of the country's leading geneticists, a longtime head of the Human Genome Project, has a Ph.D. in physical chemistry from Yale and an M.D. degree from University of North Carolina Med School. He is the author of a recently published book, actually came out this past summer, The Language of God, A Scientist Presents Evidence for Belief. It's published by the Free Press. Which he lays out his argument, as we have discussed here, that he believes that it is possible for someone to be both a scientist and a person of religious faith. We have a number of questions here, and we'll get right to them, starting next with Charleston, line 4. Hello.
Yes, two things. Differences between materialism and mysticism, which Karl Marx indicated that, and of course he was the materialist. And then H.G. Wells, who tried to predict the future, and in one of his pieces, he predicated the story on the sun going out. You know, that life was fading away on Earth, that there was, where there is no light, there is no life. And based on those observations, I would opt for the material world, because there is absolutely and utterly anything that I've ever read that a voice from the dead, I mean somebody up out of the grave and begin to pontificate about what he, where he had been and what he had done, or she, and why, the last question is, why is God silent, if there is such a thing?
So I'm not sure I completely followed the connection with the first part of the question, but let me address the second one. I don't know, and I certainly, in my own experience as a believer, have wished to hear God speak to me. I've never heard God's voice. I do think that through the process of prayer, you have the opportunity to develop a relationship with this numinous thing, this other that we call God. But I don't think that that's an opportunity to manipulate what's happening around me, but rather a sense, an opportunity to sense what God's purpose might be in my life to answer that question, why am I here, in a way that I find a prayer is useful to achieve. And I recognize that non-believers find that all very puzzling, and I certainly found it puzzling and even rather bizarre before I became a believer.
Well, what about the material existence of the sun? When that is gone, what else is predicated afterward?
Well, I don't know that God's plan includes the existence of humanity for all eternity, and I suspect we will be gone long before the sun is, especially at the rate we're going now in terms of doing destructive things to ourselves and to our own home. So I'm not sure I see that as a particularly strong argument for or against materialism. If the universe had a beginning, well, presumably it may also someday have an end, and that I don't see how that is either a plus or a minus for God's purposes in the whole thing.
And God is silent in the process.
God is silent in the sense that he doesn't come to us with trumpets and scrolls saying, here I am, but as someone who's now been on this pathway of belief for 27, 28 years, I don't think God is entirely silent either. It must suit his purposes in some ways to urge us to seek him and not make it so easy. Imagine what it would be like if God was giving us an email every day telling us what he expected us to do. I'm not sure I'd want to live in a world like that where it is all so cut and dried and we would all presumably become rather like robots.
Well, I want to thank the caller and go on to someone next in Urbana. This is line two. Hello.
Hello. This is a fascinating topic, and everything's going to be explored. But, you know, I'm totally amateur in genetics, but I'm curious, as a geneticist, if you had an opportunity to work up the genetics of Jesus, I mean, through DNA or something, and according to your Christian belief, Mary was his mother, he had no human father. I mean, so what would genetics show if you did a genetic workup of Jesus?
Sure. No, it's an interesting question, and I think it's one we won't ever get the answer to, but there are people actually who've tried to recover a little bit of DNA from the Shroud of Turin and see whether they could actually determine what's there. The problem is there seems to be a lot of controversy about the authenticity of that shroud, and certainly strong evidence that it may be much more recent than the time of the death of Jesus. I don't know what one would find. I mean, clearly Jesus was a man. He walked the earth. There's very strong historical evidence for that. When I was a kid growing up and people talked about Jesus, I thought he was a myth. But actually, the existence of Jesus Christ is as well established in history as the existence of Julius Caesar. No one who's looked at the evidence would question that he was a real person. Obviously, what you're asking is, what would turn up there? Let's say for the Y chromosome, for instance, something which males have and females do not. I guess you'd have to postulate that was God's construction of the Y chromosome to make Jesus a male. But this is pure fancy. Obviously, if God had the intention of doing something remarkable, miraculous, and supernatural in the coming to earth in human form, which is what I as a Christian believe Christ was, then it would not be a challenge for him to figure out how to engineer the genetics to make that happen.
So, I mean, it might be possible that, I mean, in your view, that the genetics that a human father would have contributed would have been, what, totally unique, manufactured from nothing with no history, that God would have fabricated something that had no antecedent just in this one case, or...
That would be one possible explanation, but of course, given that we're now moving from a material kind of argument to someone who is not purely material, namely Christ, I hesitate to guess.
Mm. Okay.
All right. Let's go to Kankakee for someone else. This is line number three. Hello.
Two questions. One, would the guest please discuss the influence of C.S. Lewis on his thinking and his faith? And two, the guest has many references in his book, The Language of God, to Western Christianity. But has the guest also had contact with or been influenced by Eastern Orthodoxy? And if so, could he discuss Orthodoxy and science? Thank you.
So two wonderful questions, and I'm not sure whether the caller was already aware just how profoundly influenced I was by C.S. Lewis, but I'm happy to talk about that. When I was struggling after that encounter with my patient on the medical wards, the one who asked me, "What do you believe, doctor?" and threw me into this great sense of uncertainty about what I knew and what I didn't know, one of the places I turned to after being guided there by a thoughtful person was to the writings of C.S. Lewis. Lewis, as an Oxford scholar and an atheist, was challenged about his atheism and set about to strengthen it, and to his surprise, ended up converting himself instead to belief in God. And so he had traveled the same path that I was on, and he seemed particularly able, therefore, to understand what my questions were on the rationality of faith. And in his little book called Mere Christianity, which has influenced thousands, hundreds of thousands of people since he wrote it some 55 or 60 years ago, I found that many of my arguments that were put together against the existence of God were actually quite much those of a schoolboy and could be readily addressed. And so it was largely through the influence of Lewis that I began to realize I had to consider that belief in God was a rational position to take. A great surprise to me, and that led me then to do a further investigation of what kind of God this might be, and of course that means looking into the great face of the world, which I discovered had a lot more in common than I had realized. But ultimately encountering the person of Christ as a unique individual who was representative of God searching for man, not just man searching for God, and I found that very compelling, and surprised as I was by the historical evidence for his existence, I became increasingly compelled with the reality of who he was and who he said he was. And after a couple of years of struggling and really not wanting to go there, because I had started down this path to try to shore up atheism, and it was comfortable for me being an atheist, I could no longer be comfortable after gaining that kind of information, and I became a Christian at age 27. As far as consideration of Western versus Eastern versions of Christianity, I'm not terribly familiar with Eastern Orthodox traditions, although I have certainly read some about them, and one of my friends is from that particular perspective, and we've talked about it. I guess, from my perspective, one of the sad things about Christianity is the way in which these same principles, the same original texts, have led people in directions that they seem to feel are unique and correct in one perspective and incorrect in another. And I would love to see us figure out a way to bring ourselves back together again around our shared principles of belief as opposed to identifying the differences. I think the Eastern traditions are perhaps more compatible with what I'm talking about as far as a harmony of science and faith, certainly more so than many of the Western Christians who attach themselves to more fundamental perspectives.
All right, let's go to Champaign next, line one. Hello.
Hi. Mm-hmm. As a when I was younger, I was a freelance photographer, and one of the things that we had in photography was infinity. It said something on infinity, and it's been something that, you know, as a mere mortal, I have a hard time getting around the concept of infinity. You know, that the world goes on and on. You know, I don't know whether other people have this difficulty or not, but I don't know whether you want to comment on that or not.
Oh, I think it's a lovely question. I mean, I think we all struggle with scales, and that's one of the reasons I think people have trouble with evolution accounting for complexity, like complexity of the human body, because it just doesn't seem like that could have happened over the course of a very accumulated set of small steps.
We didn't have an infinite amount of time for that to happen, but over 3.85 billion years, something that our minds can hardly get around. In fact, I would say most of the time we don't really have a clue what that's like, that kind of stretch of time. It is possible for really dramatic things to happen on an evolutionary basis. When it comes to infinity, of course, then you have to throw that out and go all the way to the truly unimaginable, and even the universe, we don't believe at the present time is infinite. We think there are some boundaries out there to how far it has gone since the moment of that Big Bang. Again, I think those concepts are mathematically depictable, and to get your mind around what they're really like is an extremely difficult problem and almost moves you more into the area of the spiritual than the material. There's no infinity in material things. There's only an infinity in mathematics and in your mind.
Again, I thank the call. Let's go to another Champagne person. This is line two. Hello. Let's call there, line two, Champagne.
Yes. I guess I'm that one.
Yes.
All right, I have a couple of questions.
And we really don't have a lot of time, so you can help us by being brief. I'm afraid
I
have to ask you to.
I'll have to be brief.
Yes.
Well, I'm wondering about a seed. If we buy whole wheat bread, it has the seed which has the germ in it. In other words, the life force. If we just buy wheat bread, we only have the refuse. In other words, the covering has no longer any life in it or nourishment, but it does have fiber, which we need. Now, so the life force is in the germ. Do you agree to that?
Well, I do, although in the context of the food that we eat, it is perhaps not as important as it might seem. Our bodies are going to digest what we take in, break it down into very small molecules that no longer contain that life force. They're the subunits of it, which we will then reuse by reconstructing in various ways. Obviously, to the wheat, it matters a lot whether that germ is there or not. You're not going to be able to plant it and get something to grow without that. But as a source of nutrition, whether the DNA is present or not is not going to make a huge difference into whether that particular thing can nourish our bodies.
I need to jump in here, and I hope the caller will forgive me because we're almost out of time. I just want to ask one final question. Just recently, there have been a number of books published looking at this issue of either making a rational argument for or a rational argument against religion. And one of those making the argument against, probably one of the best known anti-religionist, rational anti-religionist, if that's an appropriate way to describe him, is Richard Dawkins. He has this book that's come out fairly recently titled The God Delusion, in which he makes the argument that he thinks people who believe in God are in fact deluded, and that further that that might on an individual basis might be a problem, but it's a big problem when people so deluded get together and act together, and he makes the argument that a lot of evil has been done in the name of organized religion. How do you react to an argument like that?
Well, I think those arguments actually make me rather sad. It seems unfortunate that scientists, who obviously in the case of Dawkins and others, feel rather passionate about their atheism, choose to attack religion in such an aggressive way and to portray it in a fashion that I think is not justified as the root of all evil. Certainly terrible things have been done in the name of religion and continue to be done today. Look at what happened on 9/11. But if you look at the 20th century and you ask where was the greatest amount of human slaughter and carnage conducted, it was conducted by the regimes of Stalin on the one hand and Mao on the other, that were purely atheist regimes. So it's pretty hard, I think, to accept the idea that atheism would be the solution to all of the woes that people like Dawkins put forward. It would probably make things worse. Furthermore, it just doesn't seem appropriate when you consider the fact that atheism has to be really its own form of faith because it goes outside the evidence. It's making a claim that cannot be proven.
for someone to argue so strongly that it is the only position for a rational person. Lots of us fairly rational people are very comfortable having both a scientific worldview and a spiritual worldview, and the caricature of faith that's put forward by people like Dawkins doesn't resemble the faith that most of us hold at all. It's easy, I suppose, to draw a cartoon of something and shoot it down. Better to understand what faith really represents, better to recognize that it has done amazingly wonderful things in many instances, and better to try to come up with a way, if you don't accept it yourself, to arrive at some peaceful coexistence. I don't want to live in a society where science has to win or faith has to win. I want to live in a society where they both win.
Just very quickly, has being so outspoken about your faith, has that made it at all difficult for you to deal with some of your fellow scientists?
I've received a fair amount of feedback about my position because my email address is fairly easy to find. I will say that most of it's been very encouraging and positive. I think a lot of people in the scientific community have been troubled about this increasing tension and shrillness of the battle that they see between atheists on the one hand and fundamentalists on the other, and feel that this is not a good thing and that there should be more emphasis of the fact that there is a harmonious middle ground where many of us live, and they're glad to see that being written and spoken about. I do get some objections, and some of them come from scientists who think that it's inappropriate for someone like myself to talk about faith at all. And others come from people in the more fundamentalist part of the religious community who are deeply concerned about this acceptance of evolution as scientifically justifiable and proven, which I'm sorry to say it is. It's not necessarily the way I would have wanted it to turn out as a believer either, but the evidence is overwhelming of the descent from a common ancestor, and that includes human beings.
Well, we're going to have to leave it at that. Our guest, Dr. Francis Collins, he is longtime head of the Human Genome Project. The book, if you'd like to read it, is The Language of God, A Scientist Presents Evidence for Belief. Free Press is the publisher. Dr. Collins, thank you very much.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.